Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
At a press conference yesterday, President Trump encouraged Americans to remain calm through the coronavirus outbreak and added it will, quote, go away. I don't know. I've been super calm for 3 years now, and you're still here.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to David Simon, whose new miniseries, The Plot Against America, premieres on HBO on March 18th. David also takes a few more questions backstage exclusively for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
The coronavirus outbreak is now officially a global pandemic, and yet President Trump is still contradicting public health officials about the severity of the crisis. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Today, the World Health Organization officially called the coronavirus outbreak a global pandemic, and a WHO official said they were seeing, quote, alarming levels of inaction. And there's no excuse for that, because we've had months to learn from other countries that have been dealing with the crisis. Right now, for example, we have over 1,000 cases here in the U.S. Experts say we're basically on the same trajectory as Italy, just about 10 days behind them. And by Monday, the number of cases in Italy had shot up so drastically that the government had to put the entire country on lockdown.
All of Italy is going on lockdown. Tonight, the prime minister announcing drastic new measures just a short time ago, essentially telling everyone in his country to stay home.
More than 10,000 people have been infected with the new coronavirus in Italy in just over 2 weeks.
Italy's prime minister announced he is expanding the preventative lockdown from just northern Italy to the whole country. He said people across the country should not leave their homes other than for work and emergencies, that all public gatherings are prohibited, including soccer matches.
Do you know how bad things have to be for Italians to cancel soccer matches? Italians love soccer more than they love talking with their hands, and they love talking with their hands. If you see an Italian carrying groceries and you ask them how their day is, they have to put down their groceries to tell you. In Italy, their road signs don't even have words, just hand gestures. So that should tell you the scale of the crisis we're facing, the systemic risk. What we're seeing in Italy right now is that we could get slammed with tons of cases all at once, overwhelming the capacity of the healthcare system. And public health officials are warning that without taking extreme measures to slow the spread of the outbreak right now, we might soon see the same kind of crisis Italy is seeing.
Italy started seeing a surge in cases in February. Right now, we are tracking on par with Italy. We started seeing cases about the same time. We were just a little delayed.
We're about, 10 to 15 days behind Italy in terms of what will happen to the healthcare system.
That's it, just 10 to 15 days.
10 to 15 days.
Every country has been basically 1 week behind each other, and we're probably 10 days behind Italy.
That's right. We're behind Italy on coronavirus, and judging from our track record, we might just take whatever Italy has and make it worse. That's what we always do. For example, they invented delicious pizza with fresh local ingredients, and then we took that and did this to it.
And what are we going to make?
We're going to make crustless pizza. It's a fried cheese pizza.
Take our pineapple, and take our Parmesan, cheddar, onion, a little gorgonzola, pepperoni, throw a little mozzarella on there, then our in-house pesto. Cooks for maybe 2.5-3 minutes.
If you serve that to an actual Italian, he would scream at you until his arms got tired. So public health officials are warning us that we should be looking at Italy's crisis and doing everything possible to learn from it. In fact, we're already seeing lockdowns here in the U.S. on a smaller scale. Just yesterday, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo dispatched the National Guard to create a containment zone around an outbreak in New Rochelle just outside New York City.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that the state is setting up a one-mile, quote, containment zone in New Rochelle for 2 weeks. New Rochelle is about 20 miles northeast of New York City.
That's right, 20 miles outside of New York City. I really hope it doesn't happen, but can you imagine if they had to lock down New York City too? Who would New Yorkers take out their anger on if we didn't have visiting tourists? And there would be no one standing inexplicably at the top of an escalator, holding a map and looking confused. Nobody stopping you on 7th Avenue to ask you how to get to 8th Avenue. Times Square would just be Elmo and Buzz Lightyear taking pictures with each other. Now, again, that situation is unlikely, but there are realistic measures we can and should be taking right now to mitigate the outbreak, like canceling major public events, which states like Washington are already doing. We have to take these measures because public health officials and even former Trump administration officials are warning that our healthcare system is just days or weeks away from being completely overwhelmed.
It's Donald Trump's own former Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert who's today warning us in a statement to NBC News that, quote, we are 10 days from the hospitals getting creamed.
Tom Bossert, who was fired from the National Security Council in 2018, compared the virus to a fire threatening to burn out of control. Writing in the Washington Post, it is one we can still contain, even extinguish if we act.
That is not reassuring because you never want Donald Trump giving you advice on how to put out a fire. Remember, this is the same guy who thinks you can stop forest fires by, in his words, raking the floors of the forest.
You gotta take care of the floors, you know, the floors of the forest, very important. You look at other countries where they do it differently and it's a whole different story. They spend a lot of time on raking and cleaning and doing things and they don't have any problem. And when it is, it's a very small problem.
This guy probably thinks rakes are a solution to any crisis. Now, don't touch your face during coronavirus, but if you need to scratch, you know, use a rake. I mean, that's the guy currently in charge of responding to a public health crisis, the guy in a hat and windbreaker who looks like he wandered over from a domino game to interrupt a press conference. Have you guys tried vacuuming the fire? Because that'll work, too. Just get a vacuum in there. Seriously, what is this outfit? He wore the same thing at the CDC last week. He looks like he's at a barbecue in his backyard. He should be holding a spatula and a Bud Light screaming, who wants burgers, Chad? You want a burger, Chad? Cheese or no cheese? I got Munster, Chad. You want some Munster cheese on your burger, Chad? Chad! Chad! Grab me a brewski, Chad. Don't start playing Frisbee without me, Chad. Also, you guys, I have a cough and I've touched all the cheeses. So virtually all the experts, from public health officials to governors to Trump's own former advisors, are warning that this could get much worse without massively ramping up testing capacity and massive immediate action to mitigate the crisis. Just this morning, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and one of the world's foremost experts on infectious diseases, told Congress, bottom line, it's going to get worse. And yet here's what the president had to say to a worried nation after a meeting with Republicans on Capitol Hill just yesterday.
We're doing a great job with it, and it will go away. Just stay calm. Be calm. It's really working out, and a lot of good things are going to happen.
That's it? There's a pandemic sweeping through our population, and you sound like there's a bee in the car. Stay calm. I'm going to roll down the window. Also, what do you mean a lot of good things are going to happen? That's your answer? The World Health Organization just called it a pandemic, and the president sounds like your stoner friend trying to get you through a bad acid trip.
Don't worry, bro. Just stay calm. A lot of good things are gonna happen. Oh, I just had an idea. We should rake the forest. Would that be fun? Would that be a fun thing to do?
By the way, in case you're wondering whether to trust the president on the question of whether good things are going to happen, we currently have over 1,000 cases in the U.S. with the number rising rapidly, and yet here's what he had to say about the number of cases just 2 weeks ago.
You have 15 people
And the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero. We're going down, not up. We're going very substantially down, not up.
He could not have been more wrong. Close to zero is an insane thing to say when you're on the brink of a disease outbreak. That should be emblazoned in history as the worst presidential prediction since Abraham Lincoln said, I'm going to see like 10 plays this year. And also, just spitballing here, close to zero would make a great parody version of the Carpenter's classic, Close to You. In fact, to help you remember this awful Donald Trump prediction, come election time, we decided to see what that would sound like.
Why do you both suddenly appear every time you are near? Just like me, they love to be.
Close to zero.
Worth the long walk? But as horrible as that response was, it actually wasn't as bad as Trump's response on Monday during a press briefing by the Coronavirus Task Force. After concluding his remarks, Trump literally walked away from the podium, left the room, and let Mike Pence answer questions.
I will be here tomorrow afternoon to let you know about some of the economic steps we're taking, which will be major. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Dude, where are you going? This is your press conference. It's at the White House, and it's certainly not a move that inspires confidence.
I'm going to turn it over to Mike and get out of here because, let's be honest, this room is a germ factory. Everyone's going to be fine except for all of you.
And when Trump wanders off, he's very likely going to his TV to watch his favorite channel, Fox News, where he gets a lot of his information. And that includes this absolutely insane thing Fox Business host Trish Regan said in her show on Monday when she accused Democrats and the media of trying to use coronavirus to destroy Trump.
The chorus of hate being leveled at the president is nearing a crescendo as Democrats blame him and only him for a virus that originated halfway around the world. This is yet another attempt to impeach the president. The hate is boiling over, many in the liberal media using, and I mean using, coronavirus in an attempt to demonize and destroy the president. This is impeachment all over again.
Cool. Thank you for time traveling here from an old episode of Dynasty to tell us that. Seriously, don't you have a bunch of Dalmatians to steal? Also, you're comparing coronavirus to impeachment? Democrats aren't even talking about impeachment. They're all huddled around TVs, desperately hoping Joe Biden doesn't get in a fist fight with a voter like he almost did yesterday.
You are actively trying to diminish our Second Amendment right and take away our guns.
You're full of
Whoa! Damn! Joe! Joe! That escalated very quickly. Listen, Jack, you want to see some guns? How about these guns right here? Come on, let's go. By the way, if it is Trump versus Biden, what's the over-under for F-bombs in the first debate? Like 7? So considering how they both mangle words, it'll probably be stuff like bun of a snitch and father mucker. Would you call me? I don't know. I already forgot what I said. Come on! So Trump and his allies on Fox News are manufacturing an alternate reality where coronavirus is a fake crisis being inflamed by Democrats for political purposes, and yet at the same time, they're very eager to use it for their own political and personal benefit. Because while Trump waves away the crisis, he's also proposing bailouts for major industries that support him, like the fossil fuel and airline industries.
Since last week, we've seen a hefty drop in oil prices, down 25%, and it's now spurring fear among shale companies and also talks in the White House about federal aid.
We're going to have to talk about how do we sustain an airline industry here in the United States? We're going to need to make sure that we protect our airline industry.
We want to protect our shipping industry, our cruise industry, cruise ships. We want to protect our airline industry, very important.
That's who you're concerned about? Millions of people have no paid sick leave, and about 28 million have no health insurance. You want to bail out airlines? Airlines don't need or deserve a bailout, but if you're going to give them one, you should at least attach some strings to it, like free alcohol, room to recline without crushing the knees of the person behind you, and anyone who storms the gate before their group is called has to spend the entire flight squished into an overhead compartment. So we know Trump's response, wave the problem away, blame the Democrats and dole out cash to your wealthy buddies. But what about the Democratic response? It's increasingly becoming a major issue in the presidential primary between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, who announced today that he's staying in the race despite Biden's streak of big wins. Both Biden and Sanders have criticized Trump's response to the coronavirus, including the time Trump told people they could go to work even if they're sick.
There's no confidence in the president in anything he says or does. I wish he would just be quiet. I really mean it.
Here you have an incredibly infectious disease, and the whole world is wrestling with how we prevent the spread of that disease. To suggest to people that when you are sick, you go to work might be the stupidest advice ever made by a president of the United States.
There's something very satisfying about hearing Bernie Sanders call Trump stupid. I think it's his Brooklyn accent. You know, he reminds me of an old-timer going to a Starbucks for the first time. $6 for a coffee? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Just give me some loose beans and a hot cup of water. Now, it's clear at this point that Biden is the overwhelming frontrunner for the nomination, but it's also clear that Bernie's ideas are winning over Democratic voters. For example, Medicare for All has swept every exit poll from every state that has voted so far, and at a Fox News town hall on Monday, Bernie actually got the audience to boo the moderators for criticizing his health care plan.
So let's say you pay $1,200, $2,000 more in taxes for comprehensive health care, but you're not paying $12,000 in premiums, co-payments, and out-of-pocket expenses. Who has the better deal?
Well, that may be true for the $12,000 a year person. For the $30,000 or $40,000 a year per person who likes the health plan they have from their employer, there's 180 million Americans.
Damn, you never want to get booed by your own audience like that. That'd be like me telling a joke about Abraham Lincoln going to 10 plays. And all right. Well, I can't say I didn't ask for it. An emergency like this shows us why healthcare should be a right for all people. The coronavirus crisis is very much a broader healthcare crisis. A negligent president is lying his way through it while looking to dole out bailout money to friendly industries. Democrats should make healthcare central to their message, because if you ask Trump how to solve this crisis, he'd tell you to
take care of the floors, you know, the floors of the forest.
This has been A Closer Look.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Our guest is an Emmy Award-winning writer and creator of shows such as The Wire, Treme, and The Deuce. His latest project, The Plot Against America, premieres on HBO on March 16th. Please welcome back to the show, David Simon, everyone.
Thank you for having me back.
I'm very happy to have you back. This is a 6-part adaptation of a Philip Roth novel, and I know you've talked about this a lot. It is crazy how prescient this story was to our current political situation.
Scary. I mean, you know, what he wrote, he will even admit to you, he won't now, he's passed away, but at the time, he said, I wasn't planning on it being an allegory for any political moment of today, and yet, here we are.
Because this is his novel was about Charles Lindbergh. It was a fictional account of if Charles Lindbergh had run for president in 1940 and defeated FDR.
Right.
And Lindbergh today, again, I don't think people have any sense of the negative side of his history, which right. is that he was a fascist and basically very famous.
Anti-Semitic,
fascist, but also very famous and a hero.
Absolutely.
And his book sort of looked at how someone with that platform, with that level of fame, could become a charismatic leader of this country.
That's right. I mean, Lindbergh, in his moment, was probably the greatest standing hero we had for that generation because of the Atlantic flight and everything. And, you know, he basically lost himself in his politics. But he was a brave man, a great aviator, and in some respects, you know, Roth was very clear when I met with him the one time before he passed away to say, don't confuse him with Donald Trump in any way, because this guy actually had charm. He had a cowlick. He had a Midwestern accent. He was self-effacing.
Yeah.
I mean self-effacing on its, you know, right there. he was like, this guy was scary because he had all that. And if he had run against Roosevelt, and Roosevelt actually was worried about it in 1940, he might have won. And he might have pushed the country to the opposite side of World War II.
You have, in your career, you fictionalized a lot of actual current events and actual places and moments that we've lived through. This is your first time adapting a novel. Did you find that a lot of pressure?
I found Philip Roth a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm, okay, TV hack, Philip Roth.
Right.
You know, I mean, I had to go meet the guy.
Did he know your work at all?
No, not at all. You know, I was TV runt, you know, at his door. But I went in and... of course, I made a joke right away.
Mm-hmm.
I actually met him on the day after they had given the Nobel Prize for Literature to somebody else, to the Remains of the Day fella.
Right.
And so I had to make a joke because I'm from Baltimore and I can't help it. And so I said, what's this other guy doing with your prize? And without missing a beat, he says, at least they didn't give it to Peter, Paul, and Mary. he was still mad about Dylan.
Right, because Bob Dylan got it.
Right, he was still mad about that. But after that little icebreaker, basically, I was there to hear what he had to say and what he was worried about us getting wrong. And then I was there to say, look, you know, we're going to have to play around with it a little bit. Are you okay with that? And, you know, it was a little bit of a tender negotiation.
You talk about Lindbergh's anti-Semitism, which was not, again, what people knew him from at first. And you use some personal history, which is your father actually went to his ticker tape parade,
yeah.
I'm assuming, as someone who was very excited to see Charles Lindbergh.
My dad was 7 in 27 when he came down Broadway in the ticker tape parade after his great flight, and he was on his father's shoulders. My grandfather took him from Jersey City on the tube train to Lower Manhattan to see that. And it was one of my dad's earliest memories. He recounted it to me many times. You know, by the time my dad is 19, 20, and he's a journalism student at NYU, Lindbergh is the devil. If you're a Jewish American, Lindbergh is questioning the loyalty of Jewish Americans, suggesting that we are warmongers who want to get us into this evil war against this fine fellow named Adolf Hitler. In a single childhood to adolescence, Lindbergh transformed himself in the minds of many people. Although it is true, I mean, he is that dynamic person. That's the thing that Roth was trying to say, which was that, you know, Donald Trump was able to transform the country on populism and on fear of the other. In our case, people with black and brown skin, Mexicans, immigrants, Muslims, without the heroism, without the grand act of flying across the Atlantic. I mean, of course, if he had done it, he would have flown it better,
yeah, of course.
Faster. You know.
The fastest. A lot of people say it was the best, the first time anyone
has
done it. Yeah.
Exactly. He flew the Pacific.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, he didn't even stop. He just kept going. Yeah. But, I did all the seas.
Very good. Tasty.
You did bring some levity into this that was also a personal history. There's a wonderful scene at a dinner table where the father makes a joke, and I've read that this is an actual joke that your father made.
Yeah, you know, like in all the previous work, which a lot of it has been, you know, cops and robbers or recon Marines or Yonkers politicians, whatever else I've done, I haven't had a lot of chance to write Jewish Americans. It just hasn't come up. Suddenly, I'm in my own wheelhouse here, and so I'm stealing stuff left and right from my own family to fill in scenes. There was every Friday night dinner, my father to my mother, you know, do you know how much this soup would cost if you went downtown to Katz's and got it for $1 a spoonful? And my mother would say, every Friday night, the same line. And he'd say, every Friday night, the same soup. Bang, first episode, used that one. And then I was off and running. You know, Bernie Simon is like embedded in each episode somewhere.
Oh, that's a very nice tribute, and it's a fantastic show. I can't wait to watch more of it. Thank you so much for being here. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. David Simon, The Plot Against America premieres next Monday at 9 p.m. on HBO.
Hi, everyone. It's Sarah from Late Night. I'm here with David Simon. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The series is really spectacular. I enjoyed it so much.
Thank you.
So what you mentioned during the interview with Seth about finally getting some dialogue in that you wanted to for a long time, you have one other story of dialogue that you managed to fit into the series. Can you tell us about that one?
Oh, well, when I was 17 and in high school, this very strange thing happened to my father, who was taken hostage along with about 80 others in Washington at where he worked at the B'nai B'rith building in Washington, a Jewish service organization. And a breakaway sect, a Muslim sect from the Nation of Islam, had taken over three buildings, the B'nai B'rith, the Islamic Center, and the district building. And one person was killed. There were several people injured. But they held the hostages for about 2 days. And my father was 57 at the time. He was actually singled out as one of the old men who was untied so he could help feed the hostages during the siege. And it's a very big moment of like Yiddishkeit, but these sandwiches were sent up from the Hilton Hotel to feed the hostages, and they were bologna on white bread with mayonnaise. And yes, of course, my father's feeding this to his coworkers. They're all Jewish. And upon biting into one of the sandwiches, Sid Kloster, one of his close friends, says, "You know, bologna on white bread with mayonnaise? And are they kidding?" And my father, deadpan, said to him, "Sid, I think they're trying to kill us." Which, you know, with guys walking around with guns and scimitars, is a pretty good line.
Yeah.
So that line is sort of famous in our family. And there came a moment at the end of the miniseries after these characters have gone through this maelstrom of, you know, avoiding pogroms in the Midwest and Klan, you know, activity, and they finally make it back to New Jersey safe and sound, and they're served a sandwich at a roadside stop, and of course it's that sandwich.
Yeah.
And I had the son say to the father, you know, comment on, and you know, the father gives it right back to him, "I think they're trying to kill us."
Yeah.
I was so happy to see my father's dialogue. In my career, I've not had a lot of opportunity to write Jews, so it felt good.
I did laugh out loud when that line came along.
Well, thank you. I'm hoping my family will as well.
And you also told me a story about leading up to that you had been reminded of at a high school reunion of being in school.
Oh God, yeah. Well, the day before that happened, and I was my older sister reached me at high school in the newspaper office of the high school newspaper.
I love that you worked in a newspaper in high school.
Yes,
you really,
well, you know,
you knew what
way,
you wanted to
all
do
all the way. It was fifth period, and she reached me at the office there. She said, "Something's happening at Dad's office. Look, turn on the TV. I'll be over there to pick you up in 10 minutes." So the day before in English class, which was sixth period, we had a substitute teacher, and there was a girl. I'll name her Marguerite Bernal. She had big brown eyes. Anyway, I had a crush on her, and so I had played the fool. I'd acted out. I'd been, you know, I tortured the substitute, basically trying to get her attention, and I got thrown out of the class. I was so bad, just real acting out. So that day, I knew I was in trouble, having gotten thrown out of the class. And I go to sixth period, and sure enough, the regular teacher is there, Mrs. Hurd, and Mrs. Gallagher, the head of the English department. They're waiting for me, and the whole class is there. And I didn't remember that I did this, but I did this, apparently. I walked up, and I said, "Mrs. Hurd, Mrs. Gallagher, I know you want to talk about yesterday, but my dad's been taken hostage by a group of crazed religious gunmen, and I have to go." And the class just cracked up. They thought, now he's gone too far. Now he's suspended. He's gone. And I just turned and walked away, and they followed me down the hall, but I just ignored them and got in the car and went downtown. When I came back to school the next Monday, nobody mentioned any. It was like I was so out from under because of what had happened, you know. So, you know, it all worked out.
Yeah, that's a great story. I had heard about the hostage crisis, but I never really knew any of the details until you brought it up.
Yeah, it was, you know, I was very proud of my dad because he testified at the trial. And there were a couple of guys. What happened was this was a sect that was actually a breakaway from the Nation of Islam. And some assassins came because they were dissidents. And murdered a bunch of people where they made their headquarters in Washington. And so the guy who headed the faction, Khalees, Hamas Abdul Khalees, he really lost his mind in grief. And he took over these buildings because he wanted the convicted assassins to be brought to him. They were in Lorton at the time in the penitentiary. And that wasn't obviously going to happen. But he had really lost it. You know, it's sort of in his grief. It was very tragic. And all his followers did this. They all participated in the takeover of these buildings. But you could tell some of them really didn't want to be there and felt awful for what they were doing. And there was one guy in a knitted cap that my dad thought was so humane and so so very obviously distressed at what they were doing that my dad tried to get testimony in to help that guy. And his lawyer was not really on the job, but my dad was very frustrated about that. So my father could go through that and become very sort of, what was the word? Discerning about everybody's humanity. I was very proud of that.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing to be able to walk away from something that is so heartbreaking and tragic and probably traumatic, to be able to come away from that with something.
I was impressed that he was so discerning about who everybody was and how it had happened. And you know.
Well, he sounds like he was a great guy. Thanks for sharing those stories.
Sure. Thank you.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.